Har du et enkeltpersonforetak eller en liten bedrift? Ikke det? Nei. Nei, men da holder vi det enkelt og gir oss her, fordi vi liker enkelt. Fiken. Superenkelt regnskap.
Halv pris på Domino's pizza?
Ja, i morgen er det Crazy Tuesday og halv pris på alle medium pizza hos Domino's.
Det stemmer. Halv pris på pizza hver tirsdag.
Bestill på dominos.no eller i appen.
Crazy Tuesday hver tirsdag hos Domino's.
Velkommen til Engler og hormoner. Inspirasjon og ny kunnskap om helse, selvutvikling og livsstil.
In this week's episode, we'll be discovering how to return to running after being pregnant and giving birth. Today, there are no national nor international guidelines that standardize practice and provide a framework to support health professionals working with women who wish to return to running after having a baby. In this context, musculoskeletal pain, pelvic organ prolapse, urinary incontinence, abdominal separation or diastasis recti are prevalent amongst postnatal runners. Awareness and understanding of the importance of optimal postnatal recovery in the prevention and management of this common, but not normal, condition is increasing. And today, we're so lucky to have Grania Donnelly with us from Northern Ireland. She is an advanced physiotherapist and team lead for pelvic health physiotherapy in both public and private sector. She is also one of the main authors in the recently published guidelines, Returning to Running Postpartum. Warm welcome to you, Grania.
Oh, thank you so much, ladies. I'm so happy to be here. I'm honored to be invited onto your podcast. And I have been listening to some of the recent shows and I love the content that you're putting out and the discussions you're raising.
Thank you so much. And same back to you. I think this shared value of bridging the gap both between clinical practice, evidence-based practice, and among different health professions as well, as you are paying a major part in contributing to, is so essential for the future of women's health.
Thank you. And I completely agree. I think that there needs to be discussions like this, one, to disseminate the information that we do know to our listeners, but two, to challenge us and to raise discussion and questions so that we can maybe take that back to the research field and decide what things we do need to know more about.
Mm-hmm. And in your extensive practice, Grania, can you tell us a bit about who you are and how you came to be our guest today concerning all the clinical work and research work you have been doing already?
Yes, so I'm a physiotherapist based in Northern Ireland, which is actually part of the UK. I think a lot of people think that Northern Ireland is Ireland. It is on the island of Ireland, but it's part of the UK. And until actually earlier this year, I was working as the team lead in my public sector post as well. But I was spinning too many plates. I'm sure as women, you can appreciate that. There's too many things were happening and I wanted to explore more research. So I actually left my public sector post and I'm concentrating on my private clinic and practice and some research. So the areas I'm most interested in are diastasis recti, returning to exercise postpartum, and I have a huge interest in the role of ultrasound imaging in pelvic health as well. And I'm involved in both clinical practice and research in all of these interest areas, actually. So I've recently been furthering the research and adding to the research base in terms of returning to running, actually. So yous have approached me in relation to the clinical guidelines that we put out in 2019, which we have been delighted about the response to. But from there, there was actually some research stimulated. We had the opportunity to work with some leading researchers in the field, such as Dr. Izzy Moore from Cardiff Metropolitan University. And we actually have put out more research, which we can get into and discuss as we go along.
Yeah, perfect.
But what was your vision for these guidelines in 2019?
So these were never intended to be what they became. And I sometimes think that life's funny and things work out the way they're meant to work out. Originally, Tom Goom, who's one of the authors, he is a musculoskeletal and sports physiotherapist in the UK. And my husband, who's a physiotherapist, happened to be on one of his training courses and they got talking. Some people were asking about pelvic health and what about women returning to running. And Tom, like many people in his position would basically said that it's not his area of expertise and he doesn't really know the intricacies or the considerations for that particular population. So my husband got talking to him and mentioned that I was a specialist in pelvic health, and he was like, get her to get in touch and give me a shout. Maybe we could put out some information. When I contacted him and we decided to do something, it initially started as an idea around a blog. Let's put a blog or a fact sheet out there. Like, it wasn't intended to be the document that it was. But when we started to look at the research base for guiding females returning to exercise after having a baby, well, there wasn't much out there. And we ended up down rabbit holes trying to look at what existed for similar populations or other populations, maybe return to sport. And things got insane. Could we extrapolate and try to formulate a starting point for guiding women? And it was really a debate we had at the time, because to put out something in relation to clinical practice guidelines, the normal process is one, a very academic formulated, peer-reviewed, published document. And you can't really do that and get it published until there is significantly high-level evidence to guide that. Mm. I guess in my position as the team lead in a health trust, I was aware that as a team, we were already seeing the population of postpartum women and we're already trying to advise them and give them exercise advice. But we're all doing different things and we're all just doing what we think is the best thing because there is no standardized guidance. And my thinking was, can't wait 20 odd years until there's enough research to formulate official peer-reviewed clinical practice guidelines. Let's formulate a nice scoping review version with ask leading people in the field to peer review and perform expert opinion. And let's release it into the public domain, because another thing I'm quite passionate about is the difficulties that health and fitness professionals actually have in accessing some of the evidence-based material. Because if you don't have access to a university login or subscribe to certain journals, it's a barrier. So you're torn between wanting people to access clinic evidence-based guidance and wanting to, I suppose, adhere to copyright and different ways that journals are set up. So releasing it into the public domain was a little bit against the grain and unorthodox, but it, because there was no clinical practice guidelines out there, they really took off and went onto an international level, which we were overwhelmed by and delighted by. And yes, they stimulated, they did the main thing that we, I suppose, aimed for them to do. They have stimulated new research and a new focus on this population, which is fantastic.
Mm. And of course, this is why we found you as well, you know, because this kind of information, we're craving for it. And as a clinical practitioner ourselves, we want to adhere to evidence and we want to help our patients. And sometimes the evidence is not just there to support us to bring something back to the patient. And the fact that you also asked for feedback from the very start is so interesting, because I'm very curious about that. Has there been a lot of changes in the way you thought from you originally put down the paper and from the feedback you got into what is going to be included in the future?
Well, actually, if we even talk about the feedback from the experts who read the guidance, as we started to, I suppose, scope the research and find out what it said or what we think it says and tells us, we put forward a similar document and we sent it out for peer review, and it changed somewhat depending on the feedback. Because look, if you get a variety of clinical experts in any field or domain, there's going to be different ends of the spectrum. So we had some people saying that our guidance and approach was way too cautious. So some people thought that it was very restrictive, whereas we had lots of people were actually telling us that it was way too throwing caution to the wind, that we weren't giving people enough time and restricting them. So we were really trying to get that happy medium and sweet spot in a way that adhered to the evidence and what we can confidently say without limiting women, because as in the postpartum population, the last thing we want to do is limit people. We want to empower women, especially because they're going home and they're doing physical activity in their role as a mum. They're lifting, they're squatting, they're bending, whether they want to or not. That's just mum life. But there was a lot of debate went forward and back in terms of what we would agree on to put out. And then when we put the guidance out, we have had lots of feedback in terms of people mentioning that they have been waiting for this. Like you mentioned, Mona, nearly, it's the type of thing that we as rehab specialists are craving. We need to know what the structure is for this population, what we can benchmark against. And what's really key to note is that they're not a protocol or a prescription. Really, I would consider the clinical guidelines to be a clinical reasoning framework. They give you the information and the evidence and informed advice to then apply that into your clinical assessment. So you'll weigh up the pros and cons and you'll weigh up that individual in front of you and all the factors that are feeding into her return to running journey and decide. So even though we recommend that on average women will wait 12 weeks before returning to running, you might have someone in your clinic who everything has went really straightforward, they're recovering well, they're really keen to get back to exercise, you're happy with how their pelvic floor function is, their general function, and you may decide, let's try a graded return to running. Other women will be 12 weeks, still significantly symptomatic. They may be flagging rehabilitation needs in your evaluation, and you'll decide, you know what, we'll hold off and we'll do some strength and conditioning and revisit that return to running decision a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. So this is so important, and for us to be able to look at the individual in front of us is such a key point. And I think from all guidelines, this is the challenge, because you get this framework and you also need to bring in the clinical experience and this woman in front of you, what her experiences are previously and birth and postpartum journey. So let's jump into that. What changes in the body when being pregnant and giving birth is important to think about when we're meeting with a woman postnatally?
Really good question. Thank you, Mona. Look, there's significant physical and psychological changes that occur when we're pregnant. It's a huge life transition. It's such a positive life transition. But sometimes I think that because women give birth on a daily basis and it's a very known and established thing throughout the world, I sometimes think that the actual process of being pregnant and childbirth is taken for granted and almost belittled in terms of the changes that come about. So really, it's important that we understand that as the pregnancy progresses, our pelvic floor muscles and our perineal body actually lengthen because of that load. So even before we consider childbirth, there's changes happening to the pelvic floor muscles, which is why pelvic health and pelvic floor rehabilitation is important for every woman in the perinatal phase of life, not just those who deliver vaginally. And when we consider vaginal delivery, the levator ani and the connective tissue, that basically describes the connective tissue in and around the pelvic floor region, it stretches, I think it's up to, we've got it in our guidelines, I think it's up to 5 times its resting length. So there's significant changes in trauma to that tissue, even if someone doesn't experience a tear or actual tissue trauma that's visible, we have to appreciate that there's been a significant stretch and that there's going to be a recovery phase afterwards while that tissue, I suppose, remodels and adapts to its now unloaded and changed resting state. Abdominal wall muscles are similar. They stretch, obviously, as the pregnancy goes on. And this is one, I think, that we as the general public are more aware of because we visibly see the stretch in those abdominal muscles. And we can appreciate that after a delivery, there's going to be reconditioning needs in the abdominal wall because those muscles have been working at a lengthened position for so long. So even if you had a straightforward delivery and it was a vaginal delivery, there's still going to be rehabilitation needs in the abdominal wall just to recondition those muscles. And I also think that it's important to note that no matter how active we remain during pregnancy, there will be some degree of deconditioning in general muscle groups around the body because we move differently. We exert ourselves differently naturally to accommodate pregnancy. And so all of us are going to have reconditioning needs. And I'm a huge fan of linking pregnancy to sports medicine. I really do think that childbirth and pregnancy is an endurance event. And when we consider sports medicine for whatever the main sport is in your region, I'm sure that there are periods of the year where there's on season and then there may be a period of off season. And everyone usually appreciates that when it comes back to pre-season training, it's always really tough because you've lost some of your fitness and you've deconditioned, and the first few weeks of getting back into training are tough going as you start to regain your strength and conditioning. So I think pregnancy is the same.
It's so interesting with the load that the pelvic floor is carrying as well with regards to the action of the muscles, like starting to wear down in the muscles because of the weight instead of like the contraction and the lift that you are supposed to see. And I'm also thinking about one more thing that lengthens, and it's the ligaments to the uterus whilst the uterus is growing and the baby inside, because we can't actually feel that. But there is this change and the mobility of the uterus that are withstanding after you having delivered as well. So it's like this passive support system is stretched from the inside.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's one that we need to have much more appreciation for, because like you've mentioned about the ligaments of the uterus, we will, after pregnancy, have a new normal for our how low our cervix comes. And that's okay. But we want to make sure that it doesn't become significantly low and become something that's pelvic organ prolapse in a problematic way. But similarly, our generalized connective tissue in that region, particularly after a vaginal delivery, so our anterior vaginal wall connective tissue, our posterior vaginal wall connective tissue, generally has more distensibility. So women after having babies will have more give in those tissues. And so it increases their risk factors for pelvic organ prolapse and for just generalized connective tissue deficits. I often think this is really relevant for urinary control. And I suppose thinking of our continence mechanism, because we generally need to have nice support at the urethra. Whereas if, because of connective tissue changes, we're having more give and distensibility, that means we can have more urethral hypermobility, either on impact or on cough or on anything that increases our abdominal pressure.
Mm-hmm. So can you fill us in, Grania, on the key signs and symptoms of pelvic floor and or abdominal dysfunction?
Yeah. So yeah. Yeah, Kate, great question, because we need to know what signs and symptoms we should be aware of, and more so what we should not be accepting as normal after having a baby, because for too long, women just put up with and suffer in silence with these symptoms and think that they're just a normal part of life. But really, we're trying to highlight that if you're experiencing any leaking from the bladder or bowel, or even any urgency frequency changes to the bladder or bowel, if you're feeling a heaviness, pressure, or dragging in the vaginal area, if you've any sort of signs or symptoms of a pendular abdomen. So I know there's been a few recent podcasts on your show on diastasis. I'm sure all your listeners will be very aware of this topic. But a pendular abdomen usually can be indicative that there may be some abdominal wall separation, which isn't anything to be worried about, but it's important that you're accessing rehabilitation to make sure that you optimize your recovery. And even pelvic pain, any sort of ongoing pain in the lumbopelvic region or saddle region or vaginal area should not be accepted as normal. So if you're experiencing any of these symptoms, they are something that you should access help for because they can be overcome. In the same way as you wouldn't put up with a calf strain or a shoulder niggle, you don't put up with symptoms of pelvic floor dysfunction.
Mm. I think this is interesting because I don't know what it's like where you work, Grainier, but here in Norway, we do not have a pelvic health postnatal checkup as something every woman go through. But it's like you said, everyone is going through challenges for their pelvic floor during pregnancy. And depending on mode of delivery, you can also be impacted by that. So in your opinion, would every woman need to have a pelvic health checkup postpartum?
Yeah, in an ideal world, this would be my mission. I think that, like I've mentioned, pregnancy and childbirth is a significant life transition. There's changes happening to the body. And the process of pregnancy and childbirth can be very individualized and it can be unpredictable. We can't always control the way things occur and play out. And in the same way as, like, when I think sometimes of, you know, it's not just males who have ACL or microscopic knee surgeries, but just for the example, if we use the male football player who has microscopic knee surgery, they get like 9 months of like standardized like protocol treatment here in the UK. Certainly they get like, there's a process whereby it's recognized that they should be evaluated afterwards and prescribed exercise and rehab. So why are we underserving women? Because we know that at least 1 in 3 women experience urinary incontinence. We know that these symptoms of pelvic floor dysfunction significantly impact a woman's life. And we know that they become a barrier to physical activity and exercise. And no matter where you are in the world, we know that physical activity and exercise is a public health priority for our overall physical and mental well-being. So we need to do anything we can to ensure that women are not experiencing barriers or getting caught behind barriers to exercise. And the taboo issue is always the pelvic floor one. They don't complain or come forward about it. So we need services that screen women and educate them and inform them that, you know what, it isn't normal to be leaking from the bladder. It's quite common at this stage of life, but you should be doing some rehab or you should access help here so that you can get some, you can overcome that. But I understand that it's not always feasible. Even in the UK, we have a 6 to 8 week GP checkup, which predominantly focuses on the baby and the mum's mental health and maybe contraceptive well-being. It doesn't always focus in depthly on the type of things we're talking about today. So a lot of times there are postnatal checkups by physiotherapists, but in the UK we have a huge problem that we don't have enough pelvic health physiotherapists for the population that demand us. So that's a huge issue.
Definitely. And I think going back to the education as well, like when I was in physio school, I actually studied in the UK, we didn't have a comprehensive education on women's health. And I think that's overall for all health professions, maybe this part of women's health is not put on the agenda and the statistics is not there to support that it's actually a problem either. So I just love the idea of having a future where the woman can be empowered by knowing her status postpartum and being able to make choices to, you know, come back and be functional as soon as possible.
Yeah, and it just baffles me that we do put up with it, like that it, through generations that women do suffer in silence. Because like I've mentioned, if it was a niggle or a pain or a symptom or some sort of dysfunction in any other region of the body, we would be doing something about it because it's impacting our life. And I just find it remarkable that women do just get on with it, and they do mask, and they do come up with solutions of being able to navigate life with these significant symptoms. But we can do better, and women can do better. And I think that everything that yous are doing is helping towards that. And we all just need to keep shouting these conversations and getting them out there.
Yeah, let's replace the map of knowing all the public toilets in the city you live in with actually empowering you to be functional.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So with this regard, I mean, we have significant impact on our bodies from being pregnant and having delivered. But then we come to this postnatal period where we want to come back into physical activity. So what would you suggest, Rania, that we have a focus on from postpartum to return to running as soon as possible?
Yeah, I think it's really important that first and foremost, we honor the process that has just occurred, and we think about honoring tissue healing. And hopefully anyone listening to this who has recently delivered and thinks they've had a textbook, no issue, no complication delivery, is starting to appreciate that even with that, there will be tissue changes and changes to how much the tissue's been loaded over a sustained period of time and stretching to the tissues that needs to have some conditioning and recovery. So in the initial few weeks, I think the focus should be on tissue healing and recovery, not to limit women, because they're going to be up and functional and walking and moving, even getting up and down to chairs and toilets. We're essentially doing part of a squat movement. So you are doing physical activity, but it's all about honoring the process and not rushing it. And I suppose responding to how your body's feeling. But even from, if things are going well and, you know, from week 2-3 onwards, you probably are starting to think about maybe doing like gentle lunges, squats, and just increasing your functional movements now that you don't have a bump there and maybe limiting the way. And I just think generalized core conditioning exercises in the early days. So certainly pelvic floor muscle training that we've spoken about, so important. As I say, no matter what delivery mode you've had, we all need to be doing pelvic floor rehab after having a baby. But also some key exercises that target the abdominal wall. So I know in the early days, a lot of people tend to think of Pilates or yoga style exercises, which are nice, gentle movements, quite restorative. But I think the key is to progress to more functional activity as you can. And of course, we don't go from a period of low load or low impact exercise to one day waking up and deciding that we need to now do high impact. It has to be a graded and gradual process whereby you're starting to test out and see how muscles are responding. So as the weeks go on and you're starting to think about returning to running, you need to be doing training that builds in components of what running involves, and that's impact. So in the returning to running clinical guidelines, we have some load and impact tests, which actually are great parts of rehab or drills that you can incorporate as you train. So you mightn't be ready for running yet, but you can be starting to do some of these load and impact tests. And they include things like hopping on one leg. So it sounds simple, but if you haven't done that in 10 months, you know, it mightn't be as simple as it sounds. Even things like forward bounds, which is jumping forward with 2 feet, which is quite a lot of load. If you think about it, you're jumping forward in propelling yourself forward. So it is quite a bit of load. We have the single leg running man, which is a component of running. It breaks down that movement of running, but in a more of a balance test. And I think that's really key, just to get the body reestablishing with even the movement patterns that we're going to be doing with running. But really, the key thing about these load and impact tests is that if you were to complete these and find that you're leaking, that it initiates heaviness or pressure or pain, you're starting to flag up that you're not really managing the load as well as it's required for a high impact activity such as running, and it highlights more strength and conditioning needs. Now, it's not to say that you won't ever get back to running, but it's just to say there is more rehabilitation needs there.
Yeah. And running is quite an... it's quite a big load when running. Can we get into like what is happening in the body while we are running?
Yes, great question. Running's a high impact sport. And what that means is that when we make connection with the ground, there's a ground reaction force, is how we refer to it in research. And it's just, I think we can all appreciate the difference from walking along in a straight line to if we were to run along. It's just higher bounce, higher load. And what shock is then going up through the lower limbs, through the rest of the body. We obviously need a lot more research in this in terms of females and pelvic floor and running, because we don't actually know how much that impact hits the pelvic floor. But what we do know from a clinical perspective is that women may be fine coming into clinic when they're walking. It's when they start to run that their urinary incontinence comes on. So that change in impact certainly has some impact on the functional ability of their pelvic floor. This doesn't necessarily mean that their pelvic floor are just weak. It could be an endurance issue. It could be a response issue, because we know that the pelvic floor needs to be quite fast acting to manage high spikes in intra-abdominal pressure. So it could be that it's just a second or a component of a second behind. And as rehabilitation specialists, it's our role to identify the functional deficits that each individual are presenting into clinic with, and to, I suppose, comprise or prescribe a rehab program to address each individual's needs. Because it may not be a case of just go away and do your Kegels. That woman may have already been doing pelvic floor exercises and she's very frustrated that she's having symptoms with running. So you may evaluate and find that it needs to be, that she needs to be doing her training in relation to higher loads, because she's been lying, doing her pelvic floor exercises, which doesn't really translate to then what happens when we're up and about and running.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have some objective measures, especially when it comes to this. So you say like 10 times fast repetitions of the pelvic floor contraction.
Yeah, so we wanted to do a really comprehensive pelvic floor muscle examination. And we really, I suppose, made a point of putting this into the Return to Running guidelines with the aim that these were not just going to be read by pelvic health physiotherapists, because I think as a profession, we all connect really well with each other. We all know the, I suppose, our roles and the evidence that informs our roles. But as a group, we can be quite siloed off, because health and fitness professionals often think, or even musculoskeletal physiotherapists might think, well, I don't need to worry about that. That's for the pelvic health physiotherapist. So they don't even really have an understanding, or it's not on their radar what we do or what we evaluate. So we put in the assessment to really inform our colleagues, but also to give a bit of an outline of how comprehensive we need to be. Because yes, we put, based on the research that's out there, and I know you had Carrie Bowe on recently, and she's one of the true inspirations in the field of our understanding for pelvic floor, particularly in return to exercise. But we took from the research what we're aiming for. So it's generally considered that we want to aim for 8 to 12 repetitions of pelvic floor exercises. And we want to be able to do both fast twitch repetitions and slow twitch repetitions, because our pelvic floor has different types of fibers which function and work for different roles at different times. So if I go to cough or I go to do something really sudden high impact, that's my fast twitch fibers that need to come in. Whereas if I'm sitting on a recording a podcast and I need to go to the toilet, my slow twitch fibers are going to be what comes into play in order to maintain continence. But we also wanted to highlight that it isn't just about the muscle function, because some women coming into clinic who've been, you know, very regimentally doing their Kegel exercises during pregnancy and after, and they have a good feeling and awareness of the pelvic floor, they may come in and, yeah, they actually can activate their pelvic floor to quite a decent strength. They have their endurance, but they're still quite symptomatic. And it's then that we as physiotherapists and anyone working in this area will be able to evaluate what their connective tissue support is like, because it could be that tissue distensibility or that lack of support in their perineal body and their generalized pelvic floor connective tissue that is causing the problem. So that's where we have a measurement. It's taken from the POPQ evaluation that's commonly used in urogynecological assessments and very much used in the research base. But there's one component of it called the GH plus PB measurement, and that stands for genital hiatus plus perineal body. So it's basically a measurement from the mid-urethra to the mid-anus, and it basically gives us a resting length. So we want to know that first of all. And then we'll also asked the lady to carry out a Valsalva, which is a bear down, or if anyone's recently delivered a baby, it's the type of action we would do to push in labour. And on the third Valsalva, we're really looking to see how much, if and how much that resting length changes, because if there's a lot of distensibility or lack of support in that perineal body, it balloons somewhat. And that gives us an insight into what's happening when that woman is experiencing situations with increased intra-abdominal pressure. And it also helps us to understand the risk factor for pelvic organ prolapse and pelvic floor dysfunction in general. And it will also inform our management because, yes, keeping the pelvic floor muscles strength and condition is absolutely important with women who are presenting with a lack of connective tissue support down below. But it may be that you need to clinically reason their need for trying a pessary or a urethral support device to make up for that tissue distensibility.
That's interesting. And in the connective tissue, it's so much we don't know really, but we know now that there are some predisposing factors. Like if you have a connective tissue diagnosis, you will be more prone to having this problem.
Absolutely. So yes, things like Ehlers-Danlos or yes, connective tissue or ligament laxity disorders usually predispose someone. But also, yeah, it's a really individual thing because some women can deliver significantly big babies and have no compromise to their connective tissue and their connective tissue just responded that way. And I sometimes liken this to actually dealing with diastasis and things too, because we wonder why some women get diastasis and other women do not. And if I consider the women that I evaluate, we can start to see how their tissues respond, even when we start to see how their general abdominal wall tissue responds to pregnancy, because some women will experience stretch marks and tissue changes and other women won't. And it gives you an idea of that last recoil, I suppose, that our tissues have. I do think there would be some element of genetics that will play into this because we do have variations in the amount of collagen types 1 and 3 that we have. And that sort of sets up our starting position for how much recoil will be in the tissues.
And then we have the hormonal factors as well, postpartum. But then I just have this experience from clinic that this typical woman also will be triggered by having constipation.
Yeah.
And be of the kind that wants to support her perineum with having bowel movements because they can feel like it's filling up inside of the pelvic area.
Yeah, I think if anyone has any connective tissue changes associated with childbirth or because of other risk factors like we spoke about, whether it's genetic or that they have an established connective tissue disorder, we do have an increased risk factor for the likes of pelvic organ prolapse. And certainly I've had 4 vaginal deliveries and even in the absence of any complications, that first bowel motion post-delivery is always a bit fearful. I think we can all appreciate that if you've had a vaginal delivery, even after a C-section, because of it's the same fear. But when you have a pressure down below or you feel that area isn't supported, there is a want to maybe use a wad of tissue or a pad and splint that area. And some women may find that they actually have to use something like the Femmes we have in the UK or a thumb sometimes just to digitally splint the back wall of the vagina because they have laxity and that enables them to empty. Because otherwise they have what is termed as obstructive defecation where they feel the bowel motion. They may be able to empty the first part of it, but because it gets nearly caught in this curve of the shape of the rectum, bearing down doesn't help. It just encourages that prolapse to come down further. So it's a really uncomfortable situation and it's a really uncomfortable sensation because you're aware that there's more there and we don't get that satisfying feeling of complete emptying after a bowel motion.
And then this will also give a stretch to the tissue because it's actually deposit of the feces like in the pelvic area. So yeah,
and that can lead to irritating the bladder if you've bladder something, you know what I mean, because there's something there that usually isn't there that then can feed in. So again, there can be this knock-on effect in terms of pelvic health and how one thing impacts another. And as women, I think it's so important that we understand the changes that occur to our body, and we understand that it's okay to ask someone about this and complain because you're not alone. I think sometimes these symptoms of even feeling that they haven't fully emptied their bowel, being able to maybe feel a bulge, that can be something that's quite considered quite taboo or quite intimidating for a woman to ask about, because they feel like they are the only person in the world who will have this dysfunction as such. Mm-hmm. And yet, as I mentioned earlier, there's a device called Themis, which I think looks like a shoehorn a little bit, and it just splints the back wall of the vagina so that you can empty the bowel. And I think when we even realize that there has been a product created for this, we can appreciate there must be more than one woman out there who has this issue.
Oh, I actually did some reading on this, and I see that they had these alternatives back in the 18th century where they would make these wooden rings to support, actually. So it's been around, but it's kind of a public secret. And here in Norway, we can get it prescribed by a doctor. But then, you know, it's important to ask the questions and be aware.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So
other key muscle groups that are important to think of, not only the pelvic floor.
Yeah, so I think sometimes the perinatal period can become very pelvic focused and pelvic centric. And we have to remember that, like I mentioned earlier, there has been generalized deconditioning around the body. So we need to think about, like, if we're looking to return back to impact sport, we need to think about ankle, calf strength, quads, hamstrings, all the key muscle groups, glutes, really key muscles for running. And so we can't just decide to not be training them and all of a sudden hit off for a run. So it's really important that you're doing, particularly in the early days, when you're trying to offload the main abdominal and pelvic floor muscles to some degree, you can be doing things like, you know, hip abduction, you know, sideline hip abduction or half squats and things, and starting to get those key muscle groups going, or heel raises. And we've outlined those as strength and conditioning tests in the guidelines. Now, when I was 12 weeks postpartum after my fourth baby, I did the return to running screening. And oh, I remember going to Tom going, oh, the single leg sit to stand of a chair is tough going. I certainly couldn't do 20, but it was really interesting for me because on paper, I thought everything recovered really well. I'm doing so good. I'm ready to go running. And I remember when doing that, I was like, oh, I still have strength and conditioning needs. Now, it wasn't a barrier to me running, but it really highlighted that there's more I can be working on here. And I think that's really important. But if anyone accesses the free to access guidelines, all those exercises are outlined in them. But I think it's really important that we consider ourselves as a whole body and whole unit. And I have a clinical commentary coming out in the special edition of the Journal of Women's Health Physical Therapy in January 2022. And it's really a clinical reasoning discussion to help health and fitness professionals understand, right, how do we individualize return to running guidance for the woman in front of us? So I talk about all the factors that feed into someone's readiness to return to running. So not just their physical pelvic floor strength or their physical ability, but also looking at that woman and thinking, how much sleep has she had? Is she eating well? What's her energy reserves? Or is she entering that energy deficit? Has she any postpartum complications, such as thyroid issues, which are sometimes triggered after having a baby? How might this impact her? What's her psychological health and well-being like? Because while we understand that exercise is so important for our psychological well-being, some women can throw themselves excessively as a coping strategy into exercise. So that's also something that we need to look out for. So it's really weighing up the pros and cons of someone returning to higher impact sport and finding out, are they ready? Because you don't want too many cons, and you don't want, and you're probably unlikely to get no con. So it's just getting that balance where you think, right, this is a good decision for them to return to running, and we'll monitor it. And it's also a situation of, you don't just tell someone to go running and that's them discharged. It should be something that they're reviewed down the line about to see, well, how are they responding to that load? Are they tolerating it? Is there more rehabilitation needs that we need to identify?
Mm, this is so important. And like you say, there are different areas of our body we need to condition to be able to go back to running. And then One of the comments I have to the guidelines is, or the question maybe, is the amount of pain you can feel while going back to this activity that you haven't been doing. Because in the guidelines, I guess it says that you're not going to experience pain. But then when you increase the load and we just start moving, I'm sure everyone can relate to it. It could be a bit painful. So is it no pain, or can we accept some pain if it doesn't worsen?
Well, that's a great question, because actually more recent research, including one study that I was involved in with Dr. Izzy Moore from Cardiff Metropolitan University, it identified that 87% of the cohort that we carried a survey out on, and it was quite a high survey, it was over 800 women, so over 80% of these women had lower limb pain. So lower limb pain seemed to be the biggest issue. And similarly, there's been research carried out by Shefali Christopher in the USA. And she found that musculoskeletal pain was a huge issue in postpartum women returning to running. So yeah, I think that there could be some degree of normal aches and pains as we start to re-enter into a process of an activity that we haven't done for some time, but it shouldn't be the type of thing that progresses or that significantly impacts our quality of life. It shouldn't carry over after that run. It shouldn't intensify. If it's just normal kind of normal kind of getting used to this sort of movement again, I definitely think you will experience some DOMS, so delayed onset muscle fatigue, and that's normal and that's expected. But really, as we start to get back into the exercise, it should settle. So if you're having persistent pain, it would be something that I would highlight to someone, because postpartum pain isn't always just to do with muscle weakness and a localized area. You can have postpartum pain as a symptom of thyroid issues. You can have postpartum pain as an issue of psychological stress. You know, there can be many factors that can manifest themselves in pain. So if you're having ongoing pain that isn't responding or isn't resolving as you continue exercising, I would access someone for an evaluation to see, because it may be something that you need to get investigated further, or you may need to do specific rehab.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the observation of the symptoms as well. And in your guidelines, you say from couch to 5K in 3 months, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a slow progression.
Yes. So that's something that we have over in the UK. And I understand, do you have the couch to 5K in Norway or anything like it?
Well, I refer to you. So we have it because okay. you published.
Oh, yay. Thank you. So that can seem like a really slow progression for someone who's a keen runner. So it can, sometimes people can be like, oh, like I don't want to do that, or that great of a return. My message to you is that any other activity we undertake or any other thing that we haven't done for a while and we return to, we do a great of return. And our aim with taking this great of return is so that we can safeguard and protect your longevity running. So we don't want these stop-start cycles, which often happen, and they happen in sports medicine in terms of injury recurrence and things too, whereby people really push themselves to get back to where they want to. They may be fine, done. And then mm-hmm. they're out for a while, then back in, fine, done. I don't want that. I want women to be able to enjoy exercise and continuously, especially running, because it's free. And it's generally accessible to postpartum women around our lifestyle. So you're not tied to a time or a location. You can often take if you have a running buggy, you can take the baby. It's a very accessible form of exercise, and it doesn't have any discrimination to socioeconomic background either, which I love, because it means it's accessible. It's the same options to all.
Yeah.
I think it's a way to be smart about that as well, because you don't say anything about the intensity. So if you have short runs uphill and get higher intensity, then you can pack that the amount of kilometers you can run with really high intensity. What do you think about that, Grania?
Yes, I think that's a really, really smart recommendation, because running uphill is lower impact on our pelvic floor. It's significant. Like, you will feel the work on your lower limbs. So you feel like you're getting a nice glute workout, calf workout, quad workout. So if you're someone who really thrives on feeling like you're getting a workout and strengthening, uphill drills are really useful because they're less impact to the pelvic floor. So they're quite protective that way. And then walk down, because we know that running downhill is higher impact again than even running on the flat. And it's often why women will find they only leak on a downhill run. It's because if you think of the way we have to change how we stand to balance as we run, and you just change even the foot impact, there's so many complexities to it that we don't even understand fully yet. Mm-hmm. But we know that these trends do exist. And so we can be smart about how we can still push ourselves and get a good workout in, but decrease the load to our key areas that we're still recovering in.
Yeah. So to summarize this episode in some short key points, what do you think is the most important takeaways for our listeners?
So the most important takeaways are that every woman, no matter what her pregnancy journey looked like, no matter how straightforward it was, no matter how straightforward her delivery was, will have rehabilitation needs after having their baby, and will need to think about pelvic floor and abdominal wall recovery and strengthening. And the other thing is that no symptoms should be suffered with in silence. While it's very, very common for us to have symptoms like leaking, like heaviness or pressure in the vaginal area, like pain, in those earlier postpartum days, they should gradually settle. And if they aren't, they are certainly something that you can seek help for. There's lots of help available via specialists like the three of us sitting here today and many other specialists around the world. So we want people to know that they can access help. And overall, despite what you read on the internet or despite how people interpret different things, even like the clinical guidelines, they're not intended to be a barrier to exercise. They're intended to be something to really facilitate and protect and safeguard your longevity. So there's a mission to the madness of what they recommend, but they're also something that is continuously a work in progress. So we will be updating them as the clinical and scientific evidence presents. The last thing I wanted to mention, which we didn't touch on, was one of the biggest things we identified in that recent research with Dr. Izzy Moore, was that fear of movement was one of the biggest things impacting women's likelihood to return to running. So we do, as women, we fear the unknown. We fear what might happen if we return to running. We fear any symptoms we may be, or sensations we may be feeling. So that's where I want to say to anyone, if you're fearing the idea of returning to running, seek the help of someone who can guide you through the process, or gain some education about the symptoms you're feeling that are stimulating that fear, and overcome that, because we don't want that to be your barrier to returning.
Oh, that's amazing. It's the balancing act of giving information and still being safe to be active.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Grania, for participating in this episode.
Oh, we're thank you so much.
Ever grateful for your work and for your time. Thank you.
Oh, I've really enjoyed this discussion, and thank you so much for all you're doing. I hope someday I might be able to meet you in person.
Yeah.
Really, really would look, sharing more knowledge from your research and being able to learn from you. I'm sure we will make that happen, Grania.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.